This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott and I'm here with Ian Quinn. How are you, Ian?
Good, thanks. Great to have you visit us.
Yes. You are Mr. Alberino Man, not Alberino Brothers, but the Alberino Man in Hawke's Bay here.
Yeah, we have a good-sized planting of Alberino. We're based on the Mangatahi Terraces, sort of inland from the Hiratonga Plains, with around 5 hectares split between a Spanish and a Portuguese selection.
You might hear in the background that it's not people bunny shooting. We like to kill bunnies in New Zealand, don't we? in England, they're like, oh, I love bunny rabbits. It's not that. It's bird season, isn't it?
Yeah, we're just getting closer to harvest, probably 2 or 3 weeks away. So at this point, the grapes are getting ripe and the birds are coming looking for them.
Mm. And so you have the clappers, sometimes it's clappers, but these sound like percussion guns.
We do a mixture of things. These what you can hear is gas guns, so they just randomly fire off 3 shots. It's just an explosion of gas, doesn't harm anything. And we also use net. We ride around with an air horn in the side-by-side. And we also use a bird-scaring laser, which kind of creates movement in the vineyard and makes them a bit unsettled.
Nice.
Actually, while we're on that, one thing I've noticed is, we're sort of two-thirds organic and sort of tending more and more towards regenerative viticulture. And so the more flowers and cover crops and the more seeds that we have in around the vineyard, the more the birds are kind of focusing on that rather than grapes.
Oh, that's handy.
Yeah. Steve Smith said to me a while ago, if you think about it, the seeds have really concentrated protein and have a lot more nutrition than a grape with juice and sugar in it. So if you've got a bit more diversity in the vineyard, there's actually potential for birds to kind of focus on that a bit more than the grapes.
Well, let's get back to Alberino, because that's the topic of the conversation today, so to speak. You've got 5 hectares, which makes you the largest Alberino grower in Hawke's Bay?
Yeah, I think from memory there's something like 60, 65 hectares planted in New Zealand now. And that's probably doubled since we made the decision to plant it back in, I think it was 2017.
Mm-hmm. Why Alberino? And also, you went from 0 to 5 hectares, didn't you? That's quite ballsy, because it is quite a new grape variety for New Zealand.
Yeah, I think probably one of the biggest drivers for us planting Alberino, apart from liking it and seeing the potential of the way the market was starting to react to it, was just that we have around 50% of the vineyard is planted in Chardonnay. And Chardonnay tends to be a bit thinner skinned, a bit more susceptible to bad weather, whereas Alberino is sort of a good diversification or a good splitting of that risk, because it ripens later than Chardonnay and the skins are a bit thicker. So from a business point of view, it gives us some resilience. But fundamentally, we planted it because we like it, and there's lots of people out there that love the flavour.
Jane and I have been drinking Alberino now for being on a bit of a Alberino bend. I wouldn't call it an Alberino bender, although last night felt like that a little bit, to be honest. But we've been trying different Alberinos, and there doesn't appear to be a single style. And I think partly, possibly, because it's a new grape variety, I haven't quite worked it out. But also, there's so many different people making Alberino. You know, you actually don't even make one. You're a contract grower.
Yep.
And we've talked about contract growers on the podcast in the past, and we'll probably touch on that later on. But how many people buy your Alberino? You've got 5 hectares, so you must be
somewhere around 9 or 10 winemakers are buying Alberino. They're not all on the market yet, but what we find is, and one of the things that we're keen that they do is express their own style. So you've got a certain amount of vineyard influence on the finished wines, but if we have good diversity of people making wine in different styles for different markets, then it avoids that situation where they all taste the same.
Yeah.
That was always a great fear, but it's the way it plays out. There's plenty of diversity out there.
Tasting the same isn't necessarily a problem, particularly if you're trying to build a brand or regional style. And if you want to get international momentum behind a particular grape variety, you need to be able to say, this is what it is. But it's a bit like England, you know, England's still feeling its way for different grape varieties as well. And it takes a while to work out not only what you can grow, but also what you can sell.
Yeah, definitely agree with that.
Okay, so let's talk about the different Albarino styles that you sell your fruit to. Because we've had everything. We've had full barrel fermented, lees work, simple wines, sparkling, either, I'm not sure if it was tank or carbonation actually.
Yeah, there's a real variety. So if you just kind of run through some of the winemakers, Smith and Sheth is quite the crew Albarino that you tried. That's quite a full-bodied style, quite rich. Leave it open for 24 hours and there's a beautiful saline sourness that comes over the stone fruit. I love that. But it's, volume turned up.
Yeah, it's a big gutsy wine, Albarino.
Yeah, really attractive. Yeah, at one end of the spectrum. And if you look at, say, Kenzie, that's a lot more kind of fruit-centric with a lot of texture. Some of the others...
Is that a bit more like left field?
Probably more intensity. Okay. And more texture than left field. I think you tried the Swift Pippi, which is the sparkling one you referred to.
Was that carbonation or tank?
I think it's carbonation.
It tasted pretty good, though.
Yeah, it's fantastic for hot summer day. One of Linda's favourite wines. I had a winemaker the other day say to me, though, almost sick of Linda talking about it. Lawrence Swift, well, Pippi's a sort of fairly new bottling of Albarino. She also has a still Albarino, again, very, very fruit-driven, explosive flavour, and sort of targeted. Her whole brand is really sort of selling to that younger market.
Just on that Pippi, I thought it tasted like what you really wish Prosecco would taste like.
Okay.
Because Prosecco can be, well, often is a little bit wishy-washy these days, but I mean, that had nice, ripe stone fruits in there, all that type of thing. It was really good.
Yeah, it's sparkling and meant to be enjoyed on a hot day, but it's still got some serious flavour behind it as well.
Yep.
Yeah, Lauren's started exporting that to the UK. And so, yeah, getting really good feedback. So I think.
Who's the importer, do you know?
No, I don't.
So it looks like Albarino is quite a flexible grape variety. You know, you're seeing all sorts of wines, oaked, unoaked. Normally the Spanish do lees work anyway. We even saw some sparkling stuff, like not even just Vino Verde's little spritzy thing. Is that all the styles that you're seeing in New Zealand?
Yeah, another one would be Albarino with a bit more skin contact. So we have one winemaker, Amy Farnsworth from Amoise, who's doing kind of extended skin contact in the winery. She makes her wines naturally, or makes them as natural wines. So they tend to be more driven with that skin contact flavour.
Are they getting through to the orange? Are they orange wines, or are they not quite there? They're just like a lot of pithiness.
Quite a bit of pithiness. Earlier on, she did do two. One that was amber, and another one which was more fruit-driven.
Yep.
I think going forward, it will just be a single wine. Definitely sort of an orange tinge to it, and from that skin contact and the phenolics coming through as well.
Okay, what else have we got? What styles? So I'll tell you the ones we've had.
Yeah.
We had Left Field, which we talked about, being quite a simple style.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe a bit of lees work, but there's nothing really overt going on. That's not one of yours. We tried the crew. We've talked about Pippi. Oh, the Albarino brothers we had last night. That's one of your... No, it's not one of yours?
No. Most of Left Field and Albarino brothers is coming from Gisborne fruit.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, some of the others, Decibel, they produce a really powerful fruit-driven wine. In 24, real orange characters. So orange peel, mandarin, apricot.
Oh, okay.
And I sort of, that threw me for a little bit. But we had this, we ran a workshop with for all our winemakers. We had about 20 people there in a local MW, Stephen Wong. And brought in some around 8 reference wines from Spain.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of really taught me something in Spain.
In Rías Baixas?
Yeah.
Just
the difference between the Albarino flavours that were coming out of the coastal areas were a lot more kind of lime, yellow fruits, but you go up onto the plateau, gets a lot hotter, doesn't have that cooling influence from the sea. A lot of those wines showed those same orange characteristics. So yeah, something I was a little bit worried that we were going, we from that 24 season was a bit non-typical of the variety. Mm-hmm. When you go back and have a really good look in rare spices, that they cover that spectrum as well. And it's just down to, yeah, the seasonal, the temperatures, temperature profile during the season and how the fruit is ripened.
How do you find, because I drink a lot of Albarino back in the UK, but I must admit I'm not drinking absolute top-end, super expensive Albarinos. So how does the fruit character you get compared to maybe the fruit character when you're doing this benchmarking?
I think we definitely have a kind of a fresher new world style. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely some complexity in some of the higher-end Spanish wines that as a region we're still exploring ourselves. So I think in the Smith & Sheth wine, that's an example where the winemaker's taken quite a few different parcels, fermenting them differently, different oak treatment, different, some in stainless. And I think that's got the potential to sort of develop that complexity that we see in some of the top Spanish wines. Mm-hmm. We've also got another consortium which has been working on wine for several years. So four winemakers that have done a lot of vintages in Spain but happen to live in New Zealand, working together to chase that complexity. So that's not released, and I'll let them talk about it when the time's right. That's another attempt to look at where Albarino can go as a fine wine.
Why Albarino? Because you mentioned it works for you because it complements Chardonnay. You know, it is designed for Galician weather, you know, Vino Verde Galicia, you know, 1.5 meters of rain a year is wet. Jane and I went down to Rias Baixas a few years ago, and we were there for the days that it was dry, but you just look around, everything is green, you know it's wet. But that doesn't really tell me why Albarino, why now as well?
When we planted the top terrace, that was the second planting for us. We kind of expected to carry on with what we'd done in our first planting, which is Chardonnay, Chenin, Gamay. And what we sort of found was we kind of felt like we had enough of some of those varietals. We did plant more Chardonnay, and we're really happy that we did. But a little bit more diversity, the people were starting to get interested in Albarino, and you could sort of see the demand there. Also, honestly, personal preference is a big part of what we've done as well. Yeah, we planted Chardonnay and Syrah because we love it. We didn't really know Albarino when someone first suggested that to us. Mm-hmm. We had one or two, but the more we tried, you know, we found we loved it. It's important to do something you're passionate about. Same with growing grape varieties. I'd hate to be growing something I didn't enjoy drinking.
Yeah,
so the demand is there. It makes sense from a resilience perspective, and it's something we like.
So we're talking about Albarino and its thick skins. I've heard people talk about being bulletproof. What's your experience of that?
Yeah, certainly for the fruit is that thick skin nature of it. It's a sort of carry through weather events without sort of having the pressure that you do on other varieties from things like botrytis. But what we've learnt in the few years that we've been growing it is definitely we still need to look after the canopy. You know, it's the canopy that's producing the sugars, producing the ripeness and driving the vine. I wouldn't say the canopy itself is as bulletproof as the fruit. We still try and look after it with foliar feeds of seaweed, nutrients like magnesium that just to keep that going and through till harvest.
Are you finding things like mildews on your leaves, or is it other things?
There's definitely still disease pressure on the canopy. I think it's more around nutrition and the healthiness of the leaf, which is obviously driving the whole photosynthesis process.
I've heard people talk about different problems, particularly with global warming and concerns about maybe in places like Marlborough anyway, not Hawke's Bay, but the diurnals, they're a bit worried about diurnal temperature range being eaten away or eroded away, particularly, although I was doing some research late last night on it, and it seemed that, from what I can understand, that actually diurnal temperatures are going to get bigger.
Okay.
But what's going to happen is the nighttime temperatures are going to get warmer. The daytime temperatures are going to get hotter faster, so your diurnals are going to get bigger, but you actually want the cold, not the diurnal. It's not just the diurnal range, it's actually the temperature that you want as well.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. a couple of things. One, we're around 20 minutes inland from the Heritonga Plains, so we sort of get the heat you get down there, but being a bit...
Just on the Heritonga Plains, we're talking about Gimblet Gravels, Bridge Par, that type of area.
Yeah, and the area around sort of Hastings and Napier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're sort of slightly more elevated and away from that moderating influence of the sea. So we do get that fairly decent diurnal shift. We've had days in March where we've gone to 33 during the day and 3 overnight, so... Mm. 30 degrees of shift. I think the second thing on El Breno specifically, if you look at, say, Chardonnay, people's picking decisions, they tend to be driven by not wanting to lose the acidity, because that really gives you your freshness.
Mm-hmm.
So a Chardonnay will see the grapes becoming riper and the flavours coming through, and then quite often someone will pull the trigger on a picking decision because they don't want the acid to come down too low while they're waiting for the others to come up.
Mm-hmm.
El Breno is the reverse. It has very high acidity, and what we're normally worried about is just how we see the bricks going up, and quite often we'll see the bricks 23 to 24 range.
Potential alcohol?
13 and a half. Yep. We don't really want to go to 14, but somewhere in that 13 to 14% alcohol.
Yep.
But the acidities are still really intense. So quite often there we're actually kind of hanging on until the acidity drops to a point where we can take it into the winery and not need to do any deacidification or anything like that.
Okay, so the concern is actually the alcohol getting away on you while you're waiting for the acidity to back off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, okay, but that, if things get warmer, that won't really help because your alcohols will just creep up faster.
Possibly, but I think those warmer nighttime temperatures will also help bring down the acidity.
Yeah. Okay.
It's one of those things we just need to adapt. This year we've left kind of more leaf cover on than we normally would because we had quite a warm season. And we're playing around with things like splitting the time of pruning to try and bring ripening together. So we can't change at a vineyard level what's happening with the climate, but we constantly evolve how we're growing to try and fine tune it.
You talked about splitting the pruning, and you've got two clones that you're running here. Do you want to tell us what the clones are and, you know, how many clones are in New Zealand? How many clones of El Breno are there in the world?
Yeah, so we have two clones. One is, or selections, one is a Spanish mass selection, and the second is a Portuguese clonal selection. It's called 635. There's a couple of other Portuguese ones here in New Zealand, so it's at least four, if not, and I'm sure there's nurseries with one or two others out there.
When you say mass selection, is that literally, it's not a clone, it's you've gone through and you've just picked the plants they liked?
In Spain, they've gone through and done a mass selection there, and then that's been imported to New Zealand to one of the big nurseries here.
Mm-hmm.
And they replicate it from there. But it's not us going out and doing the selection. It's one that's been done in Spain.
No, but if you do a mass selection, those have they been clonally identified as particular clones, or is it just, it's just a mass? I'm just trying to understand it because, you know, mass selection used to be quite a... That's how you did it, and then people moved away from it, and now you're hearing about people going back to those type of older practices to get the variations.
Yeah. As far as I know, it's just a matter of going out in the vineyard and selecting vines that are growing well, producing good fruit. I know certainly for some of the Syrah selections in New Zealand that are labelled MS or called mass selection, it's literally that. There's not a single clonal instance of Syrah that it's a mixture. With the Spanish port mass selection, I'm not sure.
If you do that means you must have a reasonable amount of clonal diversity perhaps in your vineyard. Does that express itself with, do you see picking times for different parts of the vine? Yeah, because you know, you don't have a homogenous block if you've got a mass selection of different clones in there. So things like veraison and picking times and all that will vary a little bit.
Between the Portuguese and the Spanish selections we have, we definitely see differences. They have different bunch structures. They come through with different flavour profiles, and you alluded to it before, the ripening is different. In the past, we've always just grown them together, and you'd always see Portuguese 635 ripen probably 7-8 days earlier than the Spanish MS, which is not optimal because sometimes when winemakers are picking small parcels and they want to pick them both in one visit or co-ferment them, in which case you need them picked together. So what we've done this year is prune Spanish one early and the Portuguese one late to basically delay the bud burst on the Portuguese one to get them more in sync.
What pruning are you talking about here? Are you talking about the winter pruning?
Yeah, talking about winter pruning. So there's kind of a rule of thumb, every month that you push pruning later, it will delay bud burst by around a week.
Oh, I did not know that.
So we sort of have a split of probably 2.5, or probably 2 months between the two. We probably saw 10 days difference in bud burst.
Yeah.
And then they ended up flowering together, and we'll know in 3 or 4 weeks whether they ripen together or not.
All right, Ian, that's been a pretty interesting look at Albarino in New Zealand. I hope it works for you guys. Certainly the wines we've tried have been really, really good, and I'm sort of impressed with them. Cheers very much.
Yeah, thanks.